Okay, good morning, everybody. Bio 241, September 20th. And this is the only lecture I have in my recorder. Why is that? Oh, because I uploaded the one for Tuesday already. Okay, so all your lectures are there. I'll get this one on the internet maybe tomorrow night or Saturday, I'm not sure. But I have a bunch of meetings after class all the way through tomorrow, so I don't know when I'll be able to upload this onto the internet. All right, let's look at the screen on the right-hand side, which is the schedule. And we see that today is the 20th. We're going to finish up cell structure and genetic control, chapter number 3 today. And even if I don't finish it in lecture, it's finished. Okay, so I'm sure we're going to have plenty of time to talk about what we need to talk about. But you'll notice that chapter 3 is on the test that we have on Tuesday. And the way that if I don't get to cover a topic in lecture today, the way that you know what you should study is by looking at the exam study guide. Okay, so anything in chapter 3 on the exam study guide is what you're responsible for knowing. Okay, all right, so since there is an exam on Tuesday, our next meeting, you will need an 882E or maybe an 882ES form like this one right here. There's 100 questions, so I'll have 100 questions on the test. Some of them will be multiple choice. Some of them will be matching a word bank to an exam figure. The exam figures are in your study guides, right? So part of the test is going to be visual. Probably not quite half the test is visual, but a good portion of it is. So spend a lot of time, make sure you get 100% on those exam figures, right? That will give you some breathing room on other parts of the test. All right, so you need a Scantron, you need a pencil, number 2 pencil, and you also need a good eraser. So before you come to class, take your pencil on a clean white piece of paper and make a mark, and then take your eraser and erase it. If it erases, then you're in good shape. If it smudges things up, then immediately throw the eraser away. Most erasers that come with the pencils are terrible. They just smudge, and then the Scantron reader can't read the Scantron, and you'll get gypped out of course points. On the first test, if you come and see me during office hours, we can review the exam, and if it's not graded properly, then I'll give you those points, as long as I can read the Scantron. Sometimes I can't even read the Scantron either. All right, but that's only on the first test. Eventually, I'm just going to believe what the Scantron tells me. And if you make a stray mark on your Scantron or a smudge later on in the class, you won't get credit for it. Because it's really important you guys know how to fill out Scantrons properly. All right, so you just have to know how to do that, because you're going to be taking board exams with Scantrons and you'll never get those back. And if you smudge them up or make stray marks, then you're going to fail that board exam, and that means you have to take it over, which means hundreds of dollars plus a big crimp in your lifestyle, right, if you got to take a board exam over. So just practice filling out Scantrons properly, and that's by getting a good eraser is probably the most important thing, getting an eraser. Syllabus has some examples of good erasers that work. All right, so pencil, eraser, Scantron, what did I say, 882, and then also a picture ID, your Cypress College or Fullerton College picture ID. When you turn your test in, just show me your ID, and you can actually lay all that on the table when you come into class, your pencil, eraser, Scantron, and your picture ID. And actually, that's not a bad idea to have available to you when you're taking a test. Let's just say this is your picture ID right here. A lot of people sometimes when they are marking an answer for line number 22, they put a mark on line number 23 by accident because maybe the light isn't good or you didn't bring your reading glasses in or whatever. But with your ID, you can use that as a little key card and just go down line by line by line and trace the line over to make sure that you're marking your Scantron properly. Okay, so you can use that little trick. Or a ruler works too, something like that, but since your picture ID will be out, that would be fine. And you'll have the whole period until when the next class starts. I don't know when the next class starts in here, but usually we have an extra 20 minutes or so. So when microbiology is supposed to start, then the test will be over, whatever time that is. Right, so I think we get, so it's going to be more than 1 hour and 10 minutes. It's like an hour and a half or an hour and 40 minutes, something like that. More than enough time, I'm sure, for you guys. All right, so are there any questions about the test? Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6, and you know where those study guides are in Blackboard. You know the practice questions at the end of the book, the practice questions that are online, exam figures, the page numbers that you should have read, all that kind of stuff. is there for you. All right, so let's start to finish up this chapter. We were talking about protein synthesis last time. So the slideshow is right here. Pointer options, we'll make it visible, and then we'll go to this right here. All right, so we see a number of different things. We see a couple of different biological molecules. I see DNA, I see RNA, I see proteins, I see nucleotides, deoxyribonucleotides, and amino acids and things like that. So you should be familiar with all those little components. So if I look at this structure right here, you should know immediately that this is DNA, right? And you know it's DNA because it's double-stranded, but also because there's thymines as bases within the double helix. And then going from DNA to RNA right here, what do we call that process? Transcription. Remember, when we make a protein, it requires two steps. The first step starts in the nucleus, and it's called transcription. And the language of DNA and RNA is the same. They're both nucleotides, so making an exact copy of something is called transcribing, and so this is transcription. The only difference is the sugar is a little bit different. Here's a deoxyribose down in RNA. It's just a regular old ribose. And then in RNA, instead of having a thymine, it is substituted with a uracil. So that's a nice giveaway that this right here is an RNA molecule. Okay, there are about 20 amino acids, right? But there's only four nucleotides in RNA. So you have C, G, U, and A. So there can't be just a one-to-one correspondence between a base and an amino acid because there are way more amino acids than there are bases. So we need combinations of bases to determine what amino acid is placed in a protein as it's growing. And what evolution has figured out is that 3 is a nice optimal number. You could use 4 with a lot of redundancy, but that's way too much. 2 wouldn't cover all the possible combinations of amino acids. So 3 is a nice combination. So that's what we call a triplet code. So there's going to be a triplet code in DNA that corresponds to a particular amino acid within the growing protein. All right, so the primary sequence of DNA determines what the primary sequence of RNA is, and the primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA determines the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. And if you know what the primary sequence is, what does that determine? The secondary structure. And if you have a secondary structure, that determines the tertiary structure, and then the quaternary structure if the protein is called to go into many different components. All right, and then that determines the complete shape of the molecule, and the shape of the molecule determines its function. Okay, so first step in the nucleus, transcription. So you should be able to tell this is an RNA molecule, and in particular, we're going to say this is a messenger RNA molecule because each 3 of these nucleotides in a messenger RNA is going to produce something that we call a codon. So codons are found in messenger RNA. No other kind of RNA has a codon. And then codons are used to determine what amino is placed in a protein as it's growing. And on the previous slide, I think here is the universal genetic code, which stipulates what codons produce instructions for including what amino acids into a protein as it's growing. Okay, so these are codons. There is another kind of RNA molecule that brings these amino acids to the workbench where this protein is being made. Okay, where is the workbench where this protein is being made? It's in the cytoplasm. Yeah, that's the location, but there's an organelle where proteins are synthesized. In particular, this step of going from codons, right, a sequence of codons to a sequence of amino acids, that's called translation, right, because the language is different. The language of RNA is a nucleotide language. The language of a protein is amino acid, so that's a translation step right here. What's the organelle where translation takes place? That's the question I really wanted to ask you. What's the name of the organelle where translation takes place? Ribosome, and that's the second step for protein synthesis. Okay, so those are on ribosome someplace. Well, so there has to be another kind of RNA molecule that brings amino acids to a ribosome so that it can actually make a protein based on the instructions that are included in the messenger RNA molecule. And the RNA that's responsible for bringing amino acids to a ribosome is called a transfer RNA. So here is an example of a transfer RNA. It's got four loops to it, and there is an amino acyl end over here which binds an amino acid, and there's a particular enzyme that knows how to attach a specific amino acid to this end of the transfer RNA. And then on the opposite end, there is an anticodon. So you should be aware that this anticodon matches up or base pairs with the codon on what kind of molecule? Where do you find codons? On the messenger RNA. Here is a transfer RNA, and it will bind to the messenger RNA based on base pair rules, right, according to the codons that are, the anticodons that are revealed on this transfer RNA. Okay, so an anticodon is always going to be on transfer RNA. What have I called transfer RNA before? Taxi, it's like a taxi RNA molecule, right? So it's bringing amino acids that are attached over here to a messenger RNA, and this anticodon, UUA, can only bind to a particular sequence on messenger RNA. And what's going to be that particular sequence on messenger RNA? If the anticodon is UUA, it's going to be, what are the base pair rules for RNA? How about, could a C base pair with a U? No. What about a G? No. Okay. Another U? No. It's only A. So the messenger RNA is going to have a codon that says AAU. And then that's how this transfer RNA knows to bind to that particular location on a messenger RNA. All right. So every anticodon is going to be different for different amino acids. All right. So what happens? So here we have a ribosome. And we see the two subunits. There's some proteins involved in assembling ribosomes together. And remember, there's a tunnel going through the ribosome. And so think of it as like an eye of a needle. And threaded through that eye of a needle is the thread. And the thread is the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA contains the primary sequence of how to put a protein together. So the ribosome attaches to the messenger RNA, and if a lot of ribosome attach to one messenger RNA, what do we call that kind of beast? What do we call that beast that has a lot of ribosomes attached to one messenger RNA? That's a polysome that we see right here. So all these ribosomes are producing one protein that's defined by the messenger RNA, but sometimes maybe there is only one ribosome on the messenger RNA like we see in this example right here. And within the ribosome, okay, there are two locations. And I don't know if you have to know the names of these locations, right? But here is a triplet, here is a codon, and here is a codon right here. These are inside the ribosome. The one on the bottom, we still see the transfer RNA, and it has the growing polypeptide chain attached to it. The one above it contains a codon, and that codon is going to determine what the next amino acid is going to be added to this growing polypeptide chain. Okay, and how do we describe, how does this transfer RNA know to bind to this particular codon right here? So we're talking about this step right here. The codon is UCG. That is the sequence on messenger RNA. How does a transfer RNA, and what kind of transfer RNA knows to bind to UCC? Because it has to have an anticodon in this region right here of the transfer RNA molecule. The anticodon is going to base pair according to the base pair rules for RNA, and that's going to be AGG, right? AGG base pairs with UCC. So UCC is the codon. The anticodon is AGG. Where do we have an anticodon? What kind of molecule? What kind of RNA has an anticodon? Yeah, the transfer RNA. And where's the codon located? On the messenger RNA. All right, so then what happens? You have a nice peptide bond that forms right here, which is a dehydration synthesis reaction. And then the ribosome moves down in this direction. And so another codon is revealed. So the growing polypeptide chain is over here. And this reveals another codon on the messenger RNA, and that allows another transfer RNA with another amino acid and base pair, according to base pair rules. And then amino acid number 6 will join to number five in this growing chain, and the chain just gets bigger and bigger as this ribosome does what? Kind of walks down that messenger RNA. So what do we call this process right here, where you need a workbench, you need the ribosome, and you need a messenger RNA and transfer RNA to bring amino acids to the workbench, okay, and then forming this this peptide bond right here. What do we call this right here? I'm glad it's not on this slide, because that would be too easy. It's called translation, right? And where does translation take place? Cytoplasm, all right? And it is an energy-requiring process to do that. All right, so let me just see what I have on this slide right here. In a ribosome, anticodons on the transfer RNA bind to codons on the messenger RNA. Yeah, make sure you can write that statement out. Okay. Very good. And then when this ribosome reaches a stop signal, then it disassembles and you have a complete protein right here. Okay. We look at a secretory process where proteins are made with ribosomes that are attached to a membrane, in particular rough endoplasmic reticulum. So you can have endoplasmic reticulum, which is a membrane, and the ribosome assembles itself so that it has a messenger RNA going through that little tunnel right there. And as the protein is built, it is placed into the cisternae of endoplasmic reticulum. So it's not floating around in the cytoplasm, it's trapped within the rough endoplasmic reticulum membrane system. And the messenger RNA moves through the ribosome, so the protein gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And as it's made, it forms its particular shape. It takes its particular conformation. And that particular conformation can only be attained as the polypeptide is growing, as being made. You couldn't take this polypeptide chain, string it out from end to end to make it flat, let go, and then have that polypeptide chain assume its natural conformation. Its native conformation or configuration only develops just because of these bends that form as the polypeptide is being produced. Okay, so what happens if we change the conformation of a protein to some other shape? What do we call that? That's denaturation, right? And when we change the shape, even though all the amino acids are exactly the same, okay, then the function of that protein changes as well. Okay, so now what happens to this protein here that's trapped within the cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum? What's the fate of this protein right here? It is placed in a vesicle. That vesicle moves to the Golgi apparatus, and then the inside of that vesicle becomes the interior of the Golgi apparatus. And what do you know about a Golgi apparatus? It's for modifying something. So it's going to take that protein and maybe add a sugar molecule to it, or maybe a lipid molecule to it. It's going to be modified. And then it's placed in another vesicle, and that vesicle could stay inside the cell, become a lysosome or a peroxisome if there's lysozyme in there, or peroxidase, or if it's a mucus molecule, a mucopolysaccharide, which is part protein and part sugar, then that vesicle migrates to the cell membrane and it's exocytosed into the extracellular environment. And so that would be the secretory pathway. So these proteins that are made on rough ER have a fate of being secreted by the cell or trapped inside of a vesicle inside the cell, but not floating around freely in the cytosol. Okay, so that's the function of the Golgi. Secretory proteins leave rough ER and vesicles go to the Golgi, right? They are modified by adding carbohydrates to them to make a glycoprotein. And then those vesicles leave the Golgi to become vesicles inside the cell or for exocytosis, right, which is what we've talked about. Okay, DNA replication, a huge step in biology. When cells divide, DNA replicates itself and identical copies go to two daughter cells. We're going to look at some mitosis processes. Right, so does anybody know how many chromosomes a typical human cell has? Yeah, 46, right? Yeah. Well, I think maybe we talked about this. So there's always going to be an even number, right? So you've got 23 chromosomes from your mom, 23 from your dad, put them together, 46. All right, so when a cell divides, that DNA is going to be split between two daughter cells. But for mitosis, since it is an asexual reproduction process. Maybe I'll write that down. Mitosis. The model for mitosis that you should have, here is a cell, and here's the nucleus with 46 chromosomes. This is what we call the parent cell. When it divides like this into two what we call daughter cells, these daughter cells should have how many chromosomes inside them? For mitosis, yeah, 46. Exactly the same number, 46. All right, so what's the difference in color between these two cells right here, these daughter cells? I'm trying to look for a difference. Do you see a difference? Okay, the shape is the same. How about number of chromosomes? Same, color is the same, right? So these daughter cells are clones of each other. They're exact copies of each other, if mitosis has taken place properly. As a matter of fact, the daughter cells should be exactly the same as the parent cell right here. All right, but if you got 46 chromosomes and split it in half, why do you end up with 46 chromosomes? Because this DNA in the parent cell has to be replicated first. So if here is just a single chromosome like that, before mitosis takes place, this strand of DNA has to be replicated like that. They're attached together. We still consider that a chromosome, but can you see that there are actually two pieces to it that are exact copies of each other? So the daughter cells get one copy, and this other daughter cell gets the other copy of it. All right, so you got 46 chromosomes to start with, right, but it's been replicated, and then both daughter cells have 46 chromosomes. So how do we do DNA replication? All right, you have an enzyme, because you see ASE at the end of this word right here. It breaks the hydrogen bonds of a double-stranded DNA molecule to produce two free strands of DNA. So it's got to be unzipped. And that's not terribly difficult to do, because what can you tell me about a hydrogen bond? It's relatively weak, right? So it works just like a zipper, right? You could consider this helicase as a zipperase if you wanted to. All right, and the enzyme that is used to put deoxyribonucleotides together is a DNA polymerase. What kind of enzymes used to put RNA nucleotides together? An RNA polymerase. And a polymerase is just an enzyme that makes a big polymer out of these repeating units all the time. And this is going to be a deoxyribonucleotide. So DNA polymerase binds to each strand and makes a new complementary copy of the old strand. Right, just using the base pair rules, AT and GC. Right, so thus every copy is composed of one new strand and one old strand, and we call that semi-conservative replication. It would be completely conservative if you ended up with one completely old DNA molecule and one completely new DNA molecule. But you don't. The new DNA molecules have one old strand and one new strand, and so we call that semi-conservative. The original DNA sequence is preserved because we never break the primary structure of a DNA molecule. So let's look at this next slide. You'll see what I'm talking about once you see this picture. All right, so here's a DNA molecule. Again, you know it's DNA, pretty easy to tell because here's adenine, or there's a thymine right there. It's double-stranded, and it's a nice helix. So a helicase has to unwind the molecule, break the hydrogen bonds, and then the cell can read what the base sequence is on the interior of a DNA molecule. Then there is a DNA polymerase that binds. So here's the old strand, right? Can you see this is the old strand? Probably it's a little bit different color. Here's the old strand. So here's one old strand. Here's the other old strand of DNA. It's been separated. So there's a polymerase that binds over here and a polymerase that binds over here and walks along the DNA strand and incorporates in deoxyribonucleotides in this sequence, right, based on the bases in the old strand of DNA. So the old strand of DNA is a template for making the new strand, as long as you don't break the old strand of DNA or miss some of these bases right here. All right, so base pairing rules. Here we have an adenine that's going to base pair with thymine, right? And then you have guanine. That's base pairs with cytosine. So this is one strand of the old DNA. Here's the other old strand of the DNA. And again, RNA polymerase uses base pair rules to just find the complementary bases to put in the new strand. And then after the job is done, here is
one chromosome. Here is the daughter chromosome over here, but they're going to be attached to each other at the centromere, so sometimes we call these sister chromatids, and they're going to be identical to each other, except each sister chromatid has one old strand of DNA and one new strand. The other chromatid has one old strand of DNA and a new strand of DNA. And since each chromatid has one old and one new, we call that semi-conservative replication. And the other important thing to remember is that the old strand acts as a template to make or to rebuild an exact duplicate of this strand that it's missing. So this is nice semi-conservative replication. All right, so you can go from this condition here to that condition right there. Both of those are considered a chromosome, but this one has two copies of it right here that can be split apart during mitosis. Okay, so mitosis, the cell cycle. Well, let's talk about the cell cycle first. So here's the whole cell cycle. It can be broken down into two main regions. You have interphase and you have the mitotic phase. The mitotic phase is when the cell is going to undergo replication. Interphase is the part of the cell cycle where it's doing its normal everyday job. Maybe it's an endocrine cell, so it's going to be building a hormone and secreting it. But also interphase is a phase which prepares the cell to undergo mitosis. So there are a couple important distinctions right here. So it's a living phase of the cell, but it's also a growth phase within the cell. DNA replication has to occur during interphase so that when mitosis takes place, both daughter cells get the exact same copies of all the chromosomes. Okay. In interphase, the first phase is what we call G1. This is where organelles are replicated, like the centrioles, because every cell basically has two centrioles, but if a cell is going to divide, it should have four so that all cells have the right number of centrioles, as well as other organelles. The S phase is where the DNA is replicated. What kind of fashion is this DNA replicated in? Semi-conservative, right? So you end up with one old strand and one new strand. And then there's a final check before mitosis takes place during G2. That's a final growth phase. And in some cells, chromatin even condenses into chromosomes in this phase right here. But the cell really isn't dividing during interphase. It's just undergoing, it's doing its normal everyday job. Then the cell checks to make sure that it's ready to go into cell division. Cell division starts with prophase, and then metaphase, anaphase, telophase. All right, so you should know the proper, all of these different terms in the proper sequence for mitosis. That's pretty much a review for you. All right, so prophase is the first active phase of mitosis. And what happens during prophase? Let's see if I have a slide right here. Probably somewhere. Okay, prophase. All right, here's interphase. I don't see any chromosomes inside the nucleus. I see the nuclear envelope. Right? When prophase starts, chromatin condenses into chromosomes. Oh, I didn't bring a sign-in sheet today. Rats. Okay, let's start one, please. Thank you. So I know you guys are here. Sometimes I have a lot of questions from students right before class. I forget. Okay, prophase is the first phase of mitosis. We see that extended chromatin condenses into chromosomes. It's packaged around histones, and I can begin to see chromosomes. But if I look at the pattern of chromosomes right here, it's still just a random pattern. There's no orientation of chromosomes. The other thing that happens is that the nuclear envelope disappears, and the centrioles start, and I see one right here, the centrioles migrate to opposite poles of the cell. The microtubules start to arrange themselves from the spindle apparatus, and maybe I can get a little impression of some microtubules coming down over here. All right, and the microtubules are going to be important because they're going to arrange these chromosomes inside the cell and separate out the sister chromatids. So this is a good example of prophase. So the chromosomes attach themselves to the spindle apparatus at the centromere, which is right here. Here I can see the duplicated chromosomes. We could call these sister chromatids, right? It's just tightly packaged DNA molecules. And Then the spindle apparatus arranges all of the chromosomes right on the equator of the cell during metaphase. That's a very short phase, but it's very easy to see underneath the microscope. And then the next phase is what we call anaphase, where the sister chromatids start to separate. So sometimes we call these daughter chromosomes right here at this point in time. And I see a nice signal drop out, so there's no longer any genetic material right on the equator of the cell. Because the centromeres are attached to motor proteins that attach themselves to these microtubules that then start to migrate them around inside the cell, much like a way that a vesicle can move around inside the cell by attaching to microtubules. Okay, so this is what we call anaphase. And then telophase is the last phase of mitosis. The chromosomes are completely separated from each other. We begin to see a dimple form between the two cells. We call that a cleavage furrow. And it gets deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper to where finally these two cells completely separate, where the cytoplasm is separated into two daughter cells and the chromosomes are separated into two daughter cells. So each of these daughter cells is going to be identical to that parent cell at the beginning. Same number of chromosomes, no information is lost. Right, and each daughter cell has the correct number of organelles inside the cytoplasm as well. All right, so this is mitosis, and usually most books talk about the telophase. So this is telophase, when the cells split apart into two cells. And most books talk about the separation of cytoplasm as occurring during telophase. And probably that's what I want you to know for this class. So telophase is the last phase. Telo actually means the end of something or the tip of something. So this is the end of mitosis. And what happens is that the daughter cells form during telophase. That process of forming two daughter cells is what we call cytokinesis. The separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells is cytokinesis, which is a little bit different than this diagram that we see right here. Okay, we see cytokinesis as being almost like a phase of mitosis, but I want you to know that cytokinesis happens during telophase for most cell lines under most conditions. Cytokinesis might begin in anaphase for certain kinds of cells under certain conditions, but not for this class. We're just going to automatically say telophase. So here I see the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. That's what we call mitosis. And then during cytokinesis, we see the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. And that's going to happen during telophase. So that's kind of how I want you to think about what's the difference between mitosis and cytokinesis. Cytokinesis takes place within mitosis, okay? And it's just that one phase. And I want you to say telophase right here, telophase. All right, cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two separate daughter cells. But mitosis really is what? The separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. That's a nice distinction probably you should have in your mind when you think about what's the difference between mitosis and cytokinesis. All right, the other thing that happens during telophase is that the nuclear envelopes reappear and the condensed chromatin starts to extend itself so that it can be used by the cell to make proteins. So what's that first step of protein synthesis called again? Transcription. Yeah, transcription is when this chromatin right here is in an extended form, it can be used as a template to make new RNA molecules, right? And that's what we call transcription because the language is the same. All right, so that is mitosis. Something you should know, what is the function of mitosis? Why do we have this going on inside our bodies? What's the function of mitosis? There are two important reasons. One, two. Okay, because I think I heard a really good answer. At one point in time, here was a cell that had 23 chromosomes. Here is another cell, human cell, that has 23 chromosomes to it. And can anybody tell me what kind of cell this is? That's a sperm. All right. And in particular, a general form for this kind of cell that has 23 chromosomes is called a gamete. And this is a gamete over here, another kind of gamete. The sperm can swim around because of that flagella right there, This gamete can't swim around. This is what? You can say that an egg or an oocyte. Either way, it's fine with me. This is a female gamete. This is a male gamete. And then, you guys all know this stuff already, but here a sperm and an egg unite. What do we call this process? Yeah, fertilization. So here's fertilization. All right, so here are 20 paternal chromosomes. Here are 23 maternal chromosomes, so that this cell right here has 46. The name of this cell that results from fertilization is just a single cell. This is what we call a zygote. So you have to learn a little bit of biology in here. Okay, a zygote. All right, so, and then you have mitosis that takes the zygote, which is a parent cell, and produces two daughter cells. What are the reasons for that? One reason is because we were all a zygote at one point in time, just a single cell. That's not a very interesting stage in life because you can't come to a physiology class and take a test or anatomy and take practicums and things like that if you're just a zygote. You need trillions of cells to do that. So the first important reason for mitosis is growth, just to get big, right? So instead of one being one cell, you're trillions of cells right now. That's one reason. What's another reason? Anybody think of another reason? It's another reason for mitosis. Okay. Here you have one of these daughter cells. It's not going to live your whole lifetime. It's going to pass away one of these days. As a matter of fact, there are some cell lines that only live for 120 days, and that's it. Does anybody know what kind of cells you have in your body that live only for 120 days and then they croak? Red blood cells in particular, right? And we have millions and millions and millions of red blood cells. And as a matter of fact, we actually lose about 1 to 2 million red blood cells every second because that's how fast they die, all right? Does anybody know that condition in your body where you run low on red blood cells? What's that called? A pathological condition. Anemia, yeah. So if 1 to 2 million red blood cells are dying in your body every second, how many does your body have to build every second so you don't become anemic? Yeah, 1 to 2 million, exactly the same number to maintain homeostasis. And that process that replaces old and damaged cells, like all those millions of red blood cells, is mitosis. Okay, so growth is one important reason for mitosis. Another important reason for mitosis is to what? Replace old and damaged cells. So that's a second important reason. And that's just one tissue that we talked about. Okay. Another kind of interesting organ to think about that replaces itself pretty frequently is your skeletal system. Every 5 years, you get a new skeletal system. Okay, so those cells have to regenerate themselves as well. Okay. That happens by mitosis. All right, so here are two centrioles, and two centrioles come together to form a centrosome. They locate themselves near the nucleus. These are important for arranging the microtubule system inside of a cell, and I think we've mentioned that the microtubule system is a railway system inside the cell, so different cellular components can attach themselves to microtubules that are controlled by the centrosome, like the spindle apparatus during mitosis, and those chromosomes then can translocate, move around inside the cell, or vesicles can move around inside the cell. But these microtubules can also attach themselves to the cell membrane, and it can push and pull on the membrane and determine what the shape of that cell is, whether it's going to be cuboidal or squamous or columnar. And then there's some cells that are changing their shape all the time because of that cytoskeleton that's moving around, pushing and pulling on the membrane. For instance, a monocyte, which is a white blood cell, when it leaves the circulatory system, becomes a macrophage and it moves around inside your body by diapedesis. It just changes its shape. Okay, and that's due to the action of the centrosome with microtubules inside the cell. All right, so the centrosome is duplicated during G1. That's the first phase of interphase. If the cell is going to divide, and when the cell does divide, it moves to opposite ends of the cell. Microtubules grow from the centrosomes to form these spindle fibers, right? And then during anaphase, the sister chromatids separate. during anaphase. At the end of a, this is interesting, at the end of a chromosome, let me go back to this picture right here. At the end of a chromosome, even if it's already been replicated, here is the tip, or here's the end of a chromosome. Okay, and what do we call the end of something again? Telo is the end. So this is a telomere, and here's a telomere. Here's a telomere over here on a chromosome. All right, it's just the end. And when RNA is replicated, not all of the telomeres are replicated as well. So some of these nucleotides are left off. So every time the cell divides, what happens to this chromosome? It gets a little bit shorter, gets a little bit shorter, gets a little bit shorter every time a cell divides. And eventually, this, of course, this chromosome is going to disappear, right? And that's really kind of a good thing for the following reason. So think of this as the telomere right here. Every time a cell divides, then this telomere is lost, and eventually that cell line is going to die out as a result of that, unless it's a stem cell, okay? Or unless it's another kind of cell, like a cancer cell. If it's a cancer cell, there is an enzyme that replaces those nucleotides right here. The chromosome doesn't degrade, and then what happens to that cell? It can undergo mitosis basically forever. It can grow and grow and grow and grow in an uncontrolled fashion. And what is that? That's basically cancer. When you have a cell that can divide indefinitely, then it can actually take over your body. It can migrate to other parts of your body, grow there, and then undergo mitosis indefinitely as well. All right. So that's kind of an important process to be aware of. All right, so germinal cells and cancer cells can divide indefinitely. They don't age. So it's good to have cells that age, right? Because then they'll die off, and we call that senescence, and tissue should be replaced in a controlled fashion, right? But not for an indefinite period of time and not without control. Right, so these cancer cells have telomerase, which replaces telomere nucleotides, not duplicated by DNA polymerase during cell division, so that cell can live basically forever when it's undergoing mitosis. All right, so that might seem like a good idea, but that is the basis of how cancer can establish itself, because it has a telomerase which can replace telomeres during mitosis. So if you know, if there's an enzyme right here that can make a cell live forever, guess what would be a nice way to cure cancer? Develop some kind of drug that's going to interfere with this telomerase, right? And then the cell can't replace the telomeres, so then those cells can only live a very short period of time, and that'd be one way to cure cancer. So that's pretty interesting to be able to do that. Okay, meiosis. It's kind of a form of mitosis. I don't know if I have these on your study guides. Okay, I just want to say something a little bit about it. Okay, mitosis produces what kind of cells? Daughter cells that are identical to each other. So mitosis produces two identical daughter cells. Meiosis is a little bit different process. I don't know if I have a decent picture. Yeah. Pretty decent. Okay, this is a good enough picture to talk off of. So here is a parent cell, and it's going to go through one round of something that looks a lot like mitosis. It's going to produce two cells, and then there's going to go through another round of cell division, which sort of looks a lot like mitosis again. So meiosis produces not two cells, but four cells right here. And these four cells are going to be different from each other, which is a nice distinction compared to mitosis. Mitosis produces two identical daughter cells. Meiosis produces four cells that are not identical to each other. They're going to be different. Okay, the other thing that I want you to appreciate is the number of chromosomes inside this nucleus right here of a daughter cell that's produced by meiosis is going to be half the number compared to what it started with. So if there's 46 in the parent cell, then there's going to be 23 in these daughter cells produced by meiosis. And on the board, we wrote down, what do we call these cells that have 23 chromosomes in them? Yeah, they're gametes. All right, so if this is in a female, all of these gametes right here are going to be oocytes, but if it's a male, these are all going to be different kinds of sperms that carry different genetic material. Okay, so meiosis produces gametes, and mitosis produces daughter cells that are identical to each other. And you need gametes. Why do you need gametes? For fertilization to take place. All right, and so this is a sexual reproduction process, so that this individual right here, the zygote, is what? A combination of maternal information and paternal information. So the zygote is a new, unique life form. I mean, it's still human, but it's a new combination of information. And that's the reason why we're all different. And we get to talk about meiosis a little bit more when we get to reproductive chapter, which is the very last chapter in this class. Okay, but you should have a little understanding of what the difference between meiosis and mitosis. All right, so I want to answer some questions that you might have on this particular chapter, transcription, translation, base pair rules, any questions that you have. Okay, then the other thing, do you have any questions for the test coming up? So you need a Scantron, you need a pencil, a really good eraser that you have to check out ahead of time. Make sure it erases. And picture ID, Cypress College or Fullerton College picture ID? Yes. Oh, wow, I forgot. Yes, thank you for reminding me. A non-graphing scientific calculator so that you can work some questions with the Nernst equation or a pH equation. So you need a log button, at least a log button. And maybe a calculation on molarity or something, maybe. So it would be a question at the end of the chapter. Right? So anything that has been assigned on the study guide, end of chapter questions, because there's check your quantitative ability. And the answer keys are in Blackboard for that. Right? So you can practice using your calculator. All right, so on a test, you can't share pencils. You can't share erasers. Everybody has to have their own eraser. You can't share Scantrons. Obviously, you need your own Scantron. And you can't share calculators. You need your own calculator. So no sharing of equipment during the test. Right? Yeah, I think, thanks for reminding me. I might project it, but I think I have a couple hundred copies. I'll give it to you on a blank piece of paper.
Okay. So
yeah, I don't want you to bring in anything. The only thing I want you to have when I pass the test out is your Scantron, pencil, eraser, and calculator. And photo ID, five things. And your photo ID. Okay? So no periodic table. But you have to know how to use that periodic table. But it's pretty easy for this class. Right? Mostly you have to know atomic number. And then you have to know what the chemical symbols mean, is what you have to know. Like, for instance, Cl stands for chlorine. H stands for hydrogen. What about Fe? Iron, that's a strange one. Okay, because I stands for iodine. And these are all important for biochemical reasons. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have to draw out, but there'll be on the test booklet, there's going to be a figure with all the lead lines erased or labels for those lead lines, and then there's going to be a word bank, and then it's going to be matching. So figures will be a matching. It's going to be on the Scantron, yeah. So if there's a figure with a lead line that has a number by it, okay, then the answers will be A, B, C, D, E, and then maybe A, B, or A, C, and then you just pencil those letters in on your Scantron for that particular number. I like for you to draw some things in lab, and maybe I'll say something about that. Okay, I like... Yeah, there's actually a number of figures that I'd like for you to draw in lab. The first one was what? Oh, response loop. And then I never sent any other exam figures out for you to draw in lab. And some lab instructors had you do it and some didn't. And I'll have to equalize that so everybody has the same opportunity to draw those figures out. So I'll probably send an email out saying what those figures are. One is the peptide bond formation. Okay, that's an important one to write out, be able to draw. And the other one This will help you for the test, is the epithelial membrane that shows the polarity on the membrane. Apical surface has different proteins in the membrane compared to the basal surface. That's also important because you see some examples of active transport, but different kinds of active transport. How many different kinds of active transport do you know of? Two, and they are primary and secondary. What's the energy source for primary active transport? ATP. So if there's a diagram that has an ATP on it, then it's got to be primary active transport. If ATP is being broken down. And the second kind, what's the energy source for secondary active transport? Concentration gradient. That concentration gradient can be used as an energy source. And that's just basically what a battery is. It's a concentration gradient of charge. One part of the battery is positive, has a high concentration of positive charges. Another part of the battery has a high concentration of negative. And then those concentrations like to equalize, right? You like to have that flow of ions. We call that an electrical current. Okay, so opposite charges attract each other. Yeah. Yeah, all the extra credit in the lab will be drawing on a blank piece of paper always. Yeah. And what I like to do is send you that figure ahead of time in a Microsoft Word document. The figure number? I don't have the figure number memorized. Okay. But when I send the email, I'll have the figure number for you. So you can use your book as a key, but the email will contain the Word document that has the JPEG inserted into it. Okay, what else? Well, let's review a little bit. We talked about active transport, passive transport. How do molecules go for passive transport? From high concentration to low concentration. So it's a concentration gradient, which is the driving force for passive transport. What's a name for, give me an example of passive transport, a name. What could be? Yeah, diffusion. Yeah, somebody's reading my mind. I didn't know how to ask the question quite right. But diffusion is an example of passive transport, something moving from high concentration to low. What's another example of passive transport besides diffusion? How about a facilitated diffusion, right? And that's for a chemical compound that's going to move down its concentration gradient, but it's got to go through a membrane, and that particle is not permeable in that membrane. So it needs a special transporter, some kind of mechanism that allows it to move, right? That's facilitated diffusion. What will happen to facilitated diffusion when the concentration across the membrane is exactly the same? It's going to stop, right? It's going to stop because you need, for passive processes, only the concentration gradient is going to work. And another process is called osmosis. That's passive transport. How would you think of osmosis? What's happening for osmosis? Something goes from high to low, but there's some other criteria, and somebody over here said it already. It's for the solvent molecule only, not for solutes. And what's the solvent molecule in us? Water. So it's for water. So it's diffusion of water. How? Across a cell membrane, but there's got to be a special membrane. Selectively permeable membrane, right? All right, then you should know something about hypotonic solutions and what they do to cells. I think you did some lab exercises with that. What does a hypotonic solution produce? It produces hemolysis, right? A cell will expand, eventually then lyse. And a hypertonic solution will crenate cells. Okay, crenation and hemolysis are a lot different. One process is irreversible and the other is reversible. Which one is reversible? Hypertonic, producing crenation. Okay, so if you have a crenated cell, how can you get it back to its normal size and shape? Yeah, just put it in a isotonic solution, just a normal physiologic concentration of salts, and then the cell will go back exactly the way it was. Okay, you got to know some shapes of molecules. Some chemistry, and maybe we should go over that. Pretty quickly. Okay, and there's a video someplace, I forget where it is. Probably not in Blackboard, maybe it's on my website, but you should know where it is. So what the heck is this thing? Okay, I see a phosphate group, I see a sugar, and I see a nitrogenous base. This is what we call a nucleotide. Okay, not quite an amino acid, it's a nucleotide, and it's used to make either RNA or DNA, and you should be able to say which one this makes, based on this oxygen right here. Since there's an oxygen, this is for making RNA, not deoxyribo. Right, so this is not a deoxyribonucleotide, this is a ribonucleotide. Okay, that's good enough for this one. And here is a sulfhydryl group. This is used to stabilize the three-dimensional conformation of proteins. So if there's another cysteine over here, it can form a disulfide bridge, and it's a nice covalent bond that's a strong association between different parts in a protein. And then we have a amino group. What kind of compound, what's your favorite compound that has an amino group? Amino acid, but a phospholipid also has an amino group. This right here makes this hydrophobic carbon chain dissolve in water because it produces polar hydrogen bonds right here with the nitrogen. All right, so that's why a phospholipid, part of the phospholipid molecule, can dissolve in water because of this amino group. That's why amino acids can dissolve in water. Oh, the thumb wheel doesn't work. Okay, here we have carboxyl group. It's an acid group, also makes things dissolve in water. Here's a phosphate group and allows this end of the molecule to dissolve in water because of these polar hydrogen bonds to the oxygen. What kinds of elements produce polar hydrogen bonds that allow this molecule to become polar and dissolve in water? You have oxygen here. You got sulfur, nitrogen. Okay, what else? There's another one someplace. Oh, you gotta have to look that up. That's on the slide. Sulfur, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus produces polar bonds. All right, what do we got here? Long hydrocarbon chain, six carbons. Will this dissolve in water or not? Yes, the hydrocarbon chain won't, but these substitutions on that hydrocarbon chain, these hydroxyl groups, are highly polar because of this oxygen. All right, so this is a monosaccharide. Don't have to tell me which one. Here is a saturated fatty acid. Here we have dehydration synthesis reaction. And we have a triglyceride here. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol. How many carbons does glycerol have? It's got three, so think of glucose, chop it in half. You end up with something that's very similar to glycerol, and then three fatty acids. And this forms by dehydration synthesis reaction. The reverse reaction can take place, and what do we call that reverse reaction? Hydrolysis reaction. Here's another example of a monosaccharide or simple sugar. This is a micelle. What's the building block of this micelle right here? Phospholipid, right? So it's just a single layer of phospholipid. All the fatty acids are pointing into the center of the micelle because they are hydrophobic. So they like to associate with each other. What do we call this? What kind of bond do all these hydrophobic interactions produce? The kind of chemical bond that describes these nonpolar interactions between hydrophobic parts of molecules. They're called van der Waals forces. Van der Waals forces. And how strong are they in terms of chemical bonds? They're the absolute weakest. They're weaker than hydrogen bonds, weaker than ionic bonds, and for sure weaker than covalent bonds. So there's van der Waals forces that make all these fatty acids attract each other. Okay, and what group is this right here on a phospholipid? That's the polar head group. So it likes to associate with water. So this micelle can actually dissolve in water because it can form this hydration sphere around the micelle. And that micelle should kind of remind you of a cell. Okay, what are these guys? These are steroids. And what class of compounds do steroids belong to? Lipids, yeah, they're lipids. They're just nice hydrocarbon rings and chains that don't necessarily like to dissolve in water. Here is a unsaturated fatty acid. Here is an amino group. Here's a carboxyl group with a variable region on the alpha carbon. This is an amino acid. That's a general form of an amino acid. And what's this one right here? Oh, what do we got here? We got glycerol right here, three carbon chain. We got two fatty acids, but in the third position, you have a, what we call a phosphatidyl group. I don't think that's important for this class, but you have an oxygen. You got this nitrogen group right here, which means that this end of the molecule likes to dissolve in water. It's hydrophilic. This end of the molecule is hydrophobic. So a phospholipid has those two natures to it. All right, so phospholipid. All right, so if I turn these molecules around upside down or backwards, you should be able to recognize them, okay? So you might want to do that with these slides. So here is a fatty acid that's been modified. It's been bent in half and then stabilized by putting this covalent bond, making a nice hairpin turn. What are these things called? Prostaglandins, important hormones, signaling compounds inside our body. And then here we have, yeah, alpha helix, we're going to call this. Secondary structure, okay, second, and it's a building block for what kind of structure? Tertiary structure. What's the building block for secondary structure? The primary structure, which is just the sequence of amino acids. If the sequence is proper, then it can form this kind of secondary structure. All right, oh, what's this right here? Deoxyribonucleotide. So here's a nucleotide, phosphate. Ribose in the deoxy form, and then a nitrogenous base right here. This can make what kind of genetic material, what kind of nucleic acid? DNA makes a DNA. And remember, DNA has maybe two regions to it. There are the handrails that are made up of phosphate and sugar, bound to another phosphate and sugar, right? And so these things can be put together using dehydrogenase synthesis reactions. And then the base is going to be what part of the DNA molecule? If the sugar and phosphate form the handrails of a ladder, then the base forms the steps of a ladder. Okay? Okay, so that's a nice DNA precursor. Here is hydroxyl group. Here is glycerol once again. Carbonyl group. Oh, we're at the beginning already? Well, that's not so fun. Yeah, that is what, the ribonucleotide. Okay, sulfhydryl group. All right, so make sure you can identify those different chemical compounds, because I might put them as a structure on the test. Calculator, Scantron, eraser, pencil, picture ID for next time. And don't forget the sign-in sheet. Oh, good, thank you. Thanks for doing that.
So we don't have to worry about iron because iron is valence. It has either two or three on the transition metal. Everybody have to worry about that?
You don't have to know the name. You don't. Oh, eventually in your life? Yeah,
no, that's a really... calculation, because you have to know the valence electrons to be able to figure it out.
I'm going
to
pick on important ions that will adjust the membrane potential under normal circumstances, like sodium, chloride, potassium, and calcium.
Okay, so nothing in the middle.
Probably nothing in the middle, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the iron is interesting because you can play certain kinds of tricks with it.
Yeah, you got either two or three.
Yeah, yeah.
Where can we find those pictures?
Let's find them. Let me turn this off, make sure I have this turned off.